been named as Richard or Ricky Granger, aged 48, formerly of Los Angeles. Priest said, "Jesus Christ!" and slammed on the brakes. Granger is also wanted for a murder in Shiloh, Texas, 9 days ago. What? No one knew he had killed Mario, not even Star. The rice-eaters were desperately keen to cause an earthquake that might kill hundreds, but all the same they would be appalled to know he had battered a man to death with a wrench. People were inconsistent. "That's not true," Priest said to Melanie. "I didn't kill anyone." Melanie was staring at him. "Is that your real name?" she said. "Ricky Granger?" He had forgotten that she did not know. "Yeah," he said. He racked his brains to think who knew his real name. He had not used it for 25 years, except in Shiloh. Suddenly he remembered that he had gone to the sheriff's office in Silver City to get Flower out of jail, and his heart stopped for a moment. Then he recalled that the deputy had assumed he had the same name as Star, and called him Mr. Higgins. Thank God. Melanie said, "How did they get a photo of you?" "Not a photo," he said, "a photographic likeness. That must mean one of those identikit pictures that they make up." "Oh, I know what you mean," she said, "only they use a computer program now." "There's a computer program for every goddamn thing," Priest muttered. He was now very glad he had changed his appearance before taking the job in Shiloh. It had been worth the time it took to grow a beard, the bother of pinning up his hair every day, and the nuisance of having to wear a hat all the time. With luck, the photographic likeness would not remotely resemble the way he looked now. But he needed to be sure. "I need to get to a TV," he said. He jumped out of the car. The carnival ride had pulled over near the hiding place of the seismic vibrator, and Oak Tree and Star were getting out. In a few words, he explained the situation to them. "You make a start here while I drive into Silver City," he said. "I'll take Melanie. I want her opinion, too." He got back in the car, drove out of the woods, and headed for Silver City. On the outskirts of the small town, there was an electronics store. Priest parked, and they got out. Priest looked around nervously. It was still light. What if he should meet someone who had seen his face on TV? Everything hung on whether the picture was like him. He had to know. He had to take a chance. He approached the store. The window displayed several TV sets, all showing the same picture. The program was some kind of game show. A silver-haired host in a powder-blue suit was joshing a middle-aged woman wearing too much eyeliner. Priest glanced up and down the sidewalk. There was no one else about. He looked at his watch. Almost 7. The news would be on in a few seconds. The silver-haired host put his arm around the woman and spoke to the camera. There was a shot of an audience applauding with hysterical enthusiasm. Then the news came on. There were 2 anchors, a man and a woman. They spoke for a few seconds. Then the multiple screens showed a black-and-white picture of a heavily bearded man in a cowboy hat. Priest stared at it. The picture did not look like him at all. "What do you think?" he said. "Even I wouldn't know it was supposed to be you," Melanie said. Relief washed over him in a tidal wave. His disguise had worked. The beard changed the shape of his face, and the hat hid his most distinctive feature, the long, thick, wavy hair. Even he might not have recognized the picture if he had not known it was supposed to be him. He relaxed. "Thank you, God of the hippies," he said. The screens all flickered, and another picture appeared. Priest was shocked to see, reproduced 12 times, a police photo of himself at 19. He was so thin his face looked like a skull. He was trim now, but in those days, doping and drinking and never eating a regular meal, he had been a skeleton. His face was drawn, his expression sullen. His hair was lank and dull, with a beetle's haircut that must have been out of date even then. Priest said, "Would you recognize me?" "Yes," she said, "by the nose." He looked again. She was right. The picture showed his distinctive narrow nose, like a curved knife. Melanie added, "But I don't think anyone else would know you, certainly not strangers." "That's what I thought." She put an arm around his waist and squeezed affectionately. You looked like such a bad boy when you were young.
I guess I was.
Where did they get that picture, anyway?
From my police record, I'm assuming.
She looked up at him.
I didn't know you had a police record. What did you do?
You want a list?
She seemed shocked and disapproving.
Don't get moral on me, baby. Remember who told us how to cause an earthquake.
I gave up the life of crime when I came to the valley, he said. I didn't do anything wrong for the next 25 years.
Until I met you.
A frown wrinkled her brow. She did not think of herself as a criminal, he realized. In her own eyes, she was a normally respectable citizen who had been driven to commit a desperate act. She still believed she was of a different race from people who robbed and murdered.
Work it out any way you like, honey. Just stay with the plan.
The two anchors reappeared, then the scene shifted to a skyscraper. A line of words appeared at the bottom of the screen. Priest did not need to be able to read them. He recognized the place. It was the federal building, where the FBI had its San Francisco office. A demonstration was going on, and Priest recalled Melanie reading about it in the newspaper. They were demonstrating in support of the Hammer of Eden, she had said. A bunch of people with placards and bullhorns were haranguing a group entering the building. The camera focused on a young woman with an Asian cast to her features. She caught Priest's eye because she was beautiful in the exotic way that strongly appealed to him. She was slender and dressed in an elegant dark pantsuit, but she had a formidable "don't fuck with me" look on her face, and she elbowed her way through the crowd with a calm ruthlessness.
Melanie said, "Oh my God, it's her!"
Priest was startled.
"You know that woman?"
"I met her on Sunday."
"Where?"
"At Michael's apartment, when I went to get Dusty."
"Who is she?"
"Michael just introduced her as Judy Maddox. He didn't say anything about her."
"What's she doing at the federal building?"
"It says right there on the screen, FBI agent Judy Maddox in charge of Hammer of Eden case."
"She's the detective who's after us."
Priest was fascinated. Was this his enemy? She was gorgeous. Just looking at her on TV made him want to touch her golden skin with his fingertips.
I should be scared, not turned on. She's a hell of a detective. She caught on about the seismic vibrator, found out where it came from, and got my name and picture. She's smart and she works fast.
And you met her at Michael's place?
Yes.
Priest was spooked. She was too close. She had met Melanie. His intuition told him he was in great danger from this agent. The fact that he was so attracted to her, after seeing her only briefly on TV, made it worse. It was as if she had some kind of power over him.
Melanie went on, "Michael didn't say she was with the FBI. I thought she was a new girlfriend, so I kind of froze her out. She brought this older guy with her, said he was her father, though he didn't look Asian."
"Girlfriend or not, I don't like her getting this close to us."
He turned away from the store and walked slowly back to the car. His brain was racing. Maybe it was not so surprising that the agent on the case had consulted a leading seismologist. Agent Maddox had talked to Michael for the same reason Priest had. He knew about earthquakes. Priest guessed it was Michael who had helped her make the link to the seismic vibrator. What else had he told her? They sat in the car, but Priest did not start the engine.
"This is bad for us," he said, "very bad."
"What's bad?" Melanie said defensively. "It's okay if Michael wants to screw around with an FBI agent. Maybe she sticks her gun up his ass. I don't care."
It was not like her to talk dirty.
"She's really shook."
"What's bad is Michael could give her the same information he gave us."
Melanie frowned.
"I don't get it."
"Think about it. What's on Agent Maddox's mind? She's asking, where will the Hammer of Eden strike next? Michael can help her with that. He can look at his data, same way you did, and figure out the most likely places for an earthquake. Then the FBI can stake out those locations and watch for a seismic vibrator."
"I never thought of that."
Melanie stared at him.
"My fucking bastard husband and his FBI floozy are going to screw this up for us. Is that what you're telling me?"
Priest glanced at her. She looked about ready to cut his throat.
"Calm down, will you?"
"God damn!"
Wait a minute. Priest was getting an idea. Melanie was the link. Maybe she could find out what Michael had told the beautiful FBI agent. There could be a way around this. Tell me something. How do you feel about Michael now?
Like nothing. It's over, and I'm glad. I just hope we can work out our divorce without too much hostility, is all.
Priest studied her. He did not believe her. What she felt for Michael was rage. We have to know whether the FBI has staked out possible earthquake locations, and if so, which ones. I think he might tell you.
Why would he do that?
I believe he's still carrying a torch for you, sort of.
She stared at him. Priest, what the hell is this about?
Priest took a deep breath. He'd tell you anything if you slept with him.
Fuck you, priest. I won't do it. Fuck you.
I hate to ask you. It was true. He did not want her to sleep with Michael. He believed that no one should have sex unless they wanted to. He had learned from Star that the most disgusting thing about marriage was the right it gave one person to have sex with another. So this whole scheme was a betrayal of his beliefs. But I have no choice.
Forget it, Melanie said.
Okay, he said. I'm sorry I asked. He started the car. I just wish I could think of some other way. They were silent for a few minutes, driving through the mountains.
I'm sorry, priest, she said eventually. I just can't do it.
I told you, don't worry about it. They turned off the road and drove down the long, rough track toward the commune. The carnival ride was no longer visible from the track. Priest guessed that Oak Tree and Star had concealed it for the night. He parked in the cleared circle at the end of the track. As they walked through the woods to the village in the twilight, he took Melanie's hand. After a moment's hesitation, she moved closer to him and squeezed his hand fondly. Work in the vineyard was over. Because of the warm weather, the big table had been dragged out of the cookhouse into the yard. Some of the children were putting out plates and cutlery while Slo sliced a long loaf of home-baked bread. There were bottles of the commune's own wine on the table, and a spicy aroma was drifting over the scene. Priest and Melanie went to Melanie's hut to check on Dusty. They saw immediately that he was better. He was sleeping peacefully. The swelling had gone down, his nose had stopped running, and he was breathing normally. Flower had gone to sleep in the chair beside the bed, with the book open on her lap. Priest watched as Melanie tucked in the sheet around the sleeping boy and kissed his forehead. She looked up at Priest and whispered, "This is the only place he's ever been okay."
"It's the only place I've ever been okay," Priest said quietly. "It's the only place the world has ever been okay. That's why we have to save it."
"I know," she said. "I know."
Chapter 14. The domestic terrorism squad of the San Francisco FBI worked in a narrow room along one side of the federal building. With its desks and room dividers, it looked like a million other offices, except that the shirt-sleeved young men and smart-suited women wore guns in holsters on their hips or under their arms. At 7 o'clock on Tuesday morning, they were standing, sitting on desk corners, or leaning against the wall, some sipping coffee from styrofoam containers, others holding pens and pads, ready to take notes. The whole squad, except for the supervisor, had been put under Judy's orders. There was a low buzz of conversation. Judy knew what they were talking about. She had gone up against the acting SAC and won. It did not happen often. In an hour, the entire floor would be alive with rumor and gossip. She would not be surprised to hear by the end of the day that she had prevailed because she was having an affair with Al Honeymoon. The noise died away when she stood up and said, "Pay attention, everyone." She looked over the group for a moment and experienced a familiar thrill. They were all fit, hard-working, well-dressed, honest and smart, the smartest young people in America. She felt proud to work with them. She began to speak. "We're going to divide into two teams. Peter, Jack, Sally, and Lee will check out tips based on the pictures we have of Ricky Granger." She handed out a briefing sheet that she had worked on overnight. A list of questions would enable the agents to eliminate most of the tips and assess which ones merited a visit by an agent or neighborhood cop. Many of the men identified as Ricky Granger could be ruled out fast. African-Americans, men with foreign accents, 20-year-olds, short men.
On the other hand, the agents would be quick to visit any suspect who fit the description and had been away from home for the two-week period during which Granger had worked in Shiloh, Texas. Dave, Louise, Steve, and Ashok will form the second team. You'll work with Simon Sparrow, checking tip-offs based on the recorded voice of the woman who phoned John Truth. By the way, some of the tip-offs Simon is working on mention a pop record. We asked John Truth to flag that up on his show last night. She had not done this personally. The office press person had spoken to Truth's producer. So we may get calls about it. She handed out a second briefing sheet with different questions. Raja? The youngest member of the team grinned his cocky grin. I was afraid you'd forgotten about me. In my dreams, she said, and they all laughed. Roger, I want you to prepare a short briefing to go out to all police departments, and especially the California Highway Patrol, telling them how to recognize a seismic vibrator. She held up a hand. And no vibrator jokes, please. They laughed again. Now, I'm going to get us some extra manpower and more workspace. Meanwhile, I know you'll do your best. One more thing. She paused, choosing her words. She needed to impress them with the importance of their work, but she felt she had to avoid coming right out and saying that the Hammer of Eden could cause earthquakes. These people are trying to blackmail the governor of California. They say they can make earthquakes happen. She shrugged. I'm not telling you they can, but it's not as impossible as it sounds, and I'm sure as hell not telling you they can't. Either way, you need to understand that this assignment is very, very serious. She paused again, then finished. Let's get to it. They all moved to their seats. Judy left the room and walked briskly along the corridor to the Sachs office. The official start of the workday was 8:15, but she was betting Brian Kincaid had come in early. He would have heard that she had called her team to a 7 o'clock briefing, and he would want to know what was happening. She was about to tell him. His secretary was not yet at her desk. Judy knocked on the inner door and went in. Kincaid was sitting in the big chair with his suit coat on, looking as if he had nothing to do. The only items on his desk were a bran muffin with one bite taken out of it, and the paper bag it had come in. He was smoking a cigarette. Smoking was not allowed in FBI offices, but Kincaid was the boss, so there was no one to tell him to stop. He gave Judy a hostile glare and said, "If I asked you to make me a cup of coffee, I guess you'd call me a sexist pig." There was no way she was going to make his coffee. He would take it as a sign that he could carry on walking all over her. But she wanted to be conciliatory. "I'll get you coffee," she said. She picked up his phone and dialed the DT squad secretary. "Rosa, would you come to the Sachs office and put on a pot of coffee for Mr. Kincaid? Thank you." He still looked angry. Her gesture had done nothing to win him over. He probably felt that by getting him coffee without actually making it herself, she had in a way outwitted him. Bottom line, I can't win. She got down to business. "I have more than 1,000 leads to follow up on the voice of the woman on tape. I'm guessing we'll get even more calls about the picture of Ricky Granger. I can't begin to evaluate them all by Friday with 9 people. I need 20 more agents." He laughed. "I'm not putting 20 people on this bullshit assignment." She ignored that. "I've notified the Strategic Information Operations Center." SIOC was an information clearinghouse that operated from a bomb-proof office in the Hoover Building in Washington, D.C. "I'm assuming that as soon as the news gets around headquarters, they'll send some people here, if only to take the credit for any success we have." "I didn't tell you to notify SIOC." "I want to convene the Joint Terrorist Task Force, so we'll have delegates here from police departments, customs, and the U.S. Federal Protective Service, all of whom will need somewhere to sit. And starting from sundown on Thursday, I plan to stake out the likeliest locations for the next earthquake." "There isn't going to be one." "I'll need extra personnel for that, too." "Forget it." "There isn't a room big enough here at the office. We're going to have to set up our emergency operations center someplace else. I checked out the Presidio buildings last night." The Presidio was a disused military base near the Golden Gate Bridge. The officers' club was habitable, though a skunk had been living there and the place smelled foul. I'm going to use the ballroom of the officers' club.
Kincaid stood up.
You are like hell, he shouted.
Judy sighed. There was no way to get this done without making a lifetime enemy of Brian Kincaid.
I have to call Mr. Honeymoon soon, she said. Do you want me to tell him you're refusing to give me the manpower I need?
Kincaid was red with fury. He stared at Judy as if he wanted to pull out his gun and blow her away. At last he said, Your FBI career is over. You know that?
He was probably right, but it hurt to hear him say it.
I never wanted to fight with you, Brian, she said, striving to keep her voice low and reasonable. But you dicked me around. I deserved a promotion after putting the Fung brothers away. Instead, you promoted your buddy and gave me a bullshit assignment. You shouldn't have done that. It was unprofessional.
Don't tell me how to...
She overrode him.
When the bullshit assignment turned into a big case, you took it away from me, then screwed it up. Every bad thing that's happening to you is your own damn fault. Now you're sulking. Well, I know your pride is wounded, and I know your feelings are hurt, and I just want you to understand that I don't give a flying fuck.
He stared at her with his mouth half open. She went to the door.
Now I'm going to talk to Honeymoon at 9:30, she said. By then, I'd like to have a senior logistics person assigned to my team with the authority to organize the manpower I need and set up a command post at the officers' club. If I don't, I'll tell Honeymoon to call Washington. Your move.
She went out and slammed the door. She felt the exhilaration that comes from a reckless act. She would have to fight every step, so she might as well fight hard. She would never be able to work with Kincaid again. The Bureau's top brass would side with the superior officer in a situation like this. She was almost certainly finished. But this case was more important than her career. Hundreds of lives might be at stake. If she could prevent a catastrophe and capture the terrorists, she would retire proudly and to hell with them all. The DT squad secretary was in Kincaid's outer office, filling the coffee machine.
Thanks, Rosa, Judy said as she passed through.
She returned to the DT office. The phone on her desk was ringing. She picked up.
Judy Maddox.
John Truth here.
Hello.
It was weird to hear the familiar radio voice on the other end of a phone.
You're at work early.
I'm at home, but my producer just called me. My voicemail at the radio station was maxed with overnight calls about the Hammer of Eden woman.
Judy was not supposed to talk to the media herself. All such contacts should go through the office media specialist, Madge Kelly, a young agent with a journalism degree. But Truth was not asking her for a quote, he was giving her information, and she was in too much of a hurry to tell Truth to call Madge.
Anything good? She asked.
You bet. I got two people who remembered the name of the record.
No kidding.
Judy was thrilled.
This woman was reading poetry over a background of psychedelic music.
Yuck.
Yeah. He laughed. The album was called Raining Fresh Daisies. That also seems to be the name of the band, or group, as they used to call them then.
He seemed pleasant and friendly, nothing like the spiteful creep he was on air. Maybe that was just an act. But you could never trust media people. Judy said, I never heard of them.
Me either, before my time, I guess. And we sure don't have the disc at the radio station.
Did either of your callers give you a catalog number or even the name of the record label?
Nope. My producer called both people back, but they don't actually have the record. They just remember it.
Damn. I guess we'll just have to call every record company. I wonder if they keep files that far back.
The album may have come out on a minor league label that no longer exists. It sounds like that kind of far-out stuff. Want to know what I'd do?
Sure.
Haight-Ashbury is full of second-hand record stores with clerks who live in a time warp. I'd check them out.
Good idea. Thanks.
You're welcome. Now, how's the investigation going otherwise?
We're making some progress. Can I get our press officer to call you later with details?
Come on. I just done you a favor, haven't I?
You sure have, and I wish I could give you an interview, but agents aren't allowed to talk directly to the media. I'm really sorry.
His tone turned aggressive. Is it the thanks you give to our listeners for calling in with information for you?
A dreadful thought struck her.
Are you taping this? You don't mind, do you?
She hung up.
Shit.
She had been trapped. Talking to the media without authorization was what the FBI called a bright line issue,
meaning you could be fired for it. If John Truth played his tape of their conversation over the air, Judy would be in trouble. She could argue that she had urgently needed the information Truth offered, and a decent boss would probably let her off with a reprimand, but Kincaid would make the most of it. Heck, Judy, you're already in so much trouble, this won't make any difference. Roger Kahn walked up to her desk with a sheet of paper in his hand.
Would you like to see this before it goes out? It's the memo to police officers about how to recognize a seismic vibrator.
That was quick.
What took you so long? She said, joshing him. I had to look up how to spell seismic.
She smiled and glanced over what he had written. It was fine.
This is great. Send it out.
She handed back the sheet. Now I have another job for you. We're looking for an album called Raining Fresh Daisies. It's from the 60s.
No kidding.
She grinned. Yeah, it does have kind of a hippie feel to it. The voice on the record is the Hammer of Eden woman, and I'm hoping we'll get a name for her. If the label still exists, we might even get a last known address. I want you to contact all the major recording companies, then call stores that sell rare records.
He looked at his watch. It's not yet 9, but I can start with the East Coast.
Get to it. Roger went to his desk. Judy picked up the phone and dialed police headquarters.
Lieutenant Maddox, please.
A moment later, he came on the line. She said, Beau, it's me.
Hi, Judy.
Cast your mind back to the late 60s, when you knew what music was hip.
I'd have to go further. Early 60s, late 50s. That's my era.
Too bad. I think the Hammer of Eden woman made a record with a band called Raining Fresh Daisies.
My favorite groups were called things like Frankie Rock and the Rockabillies. I never liked acts with flowers in their names.
Sorry, Jude, I never heard of your outfit.
Well, it was worth a try.
Listen, I'm glad you called. I've been thinking about your guy, Ricky Granger. He's the man behind the woman, right?
That's what we think.
You know, he's so careful. He's such a planner. He must be dying to know what you're up to.
Makes sense.
I think the FBI has probably talked to him already.
You do?
That was hopeful, if Beau was right.
There was a type of perpetrator who insinuated himself into the investigation, approaching the police as a witness or a kindly neighbor offering coffee, then tried to befriend officers and chat to them about the progress of the case.
But Granger also seems ultra-careful.
There's probably a war going on inside him between caution and curiosity. But look at his behavior. He's daring as all hell. My guess is curiosity will win out.
Judy nodded into the phone. Beau's intuitions were worth listening to. They came from 30 years of police experience.
I'm going to review every interview in the case.
Look for something off the wall. This guy never does the normal thing. He'll be a psychic offering to divine where the next earthquake will come or like that. He's imaginative.
Okay. Anything else?
What do you want for supper?
I probably won't be home.
Don't overdo it.
Beau, I have 3 days to catch these people. If I fail, hundreds of people could die. I'm not thinking about supper.
If you get tired, you'll miss the crucial clue. Take breaks, eat lunch, get the sleep you need.
Like you always did, huh?
He laughed. Good luck.
Bye.
She hung up, frowning. She would have to go over every interview Marvin's team had done with the Green California campaign people, plus all the notes from the raid on Los Alamos and anything else in the file. It should all be on the office computer network. She touched her keyboard and called up the directory. As she scanned the material, she realized there was far too much for her to review personally. They had interviewed every householder in Silver River Valley, more than 100 people. When she got her extra personnel, she would put a small team on it. She made a note. What else? She had to arrange stakeouts on likely earthquake sites. Michael had said he could make a list. She was glad to have a reason to call him. She dialed his number. He sounded pleased to hear from her.
I'm looking forward to our date tonight.
Shit, I forgot all about it. I've been put back on the Hammer of Eden case, she told him.
Does that mean you can't make it tonight?
He sounded crestfallen. She certainly could not contemplate dinner and a movie.
I'd like to see you, but I won't have much time. Could we meet for a drink, maybe?
Sure. I'm really sorry, but the case is developing fast. I called you about that list you promised of likely earthquake sites. Did you make it?
No, you got anxious about the information getting out to the public and causing a panic, and that made me think the exercise might be dangerous.
Now I need to know.
Okay, I'll look at the data.
Could you bring the list with you tonight?
Sure, Morton's at 6.
See you there.
Listen.
Still here?
I'm really glad you're back on the case. I'm sorry we can't have dinner together, but I feel safer knowing you're after the bad guys. I mean it.
Thanks.
As she hung up, she hoped she merited his confidence. 3 days left.
By mid-afternoon, the Emergency Operations Center was up and running. The officers' club looked like a Spanish villa. Inside, it was a gloomy imitation of a country club, with cheap paneling, bad murals, and ugly light fixtures. The smell of the skunk had not gone away. The cavernous ballroom had been fitted out as a command post. In one corner was the head shed, a top table with seats for the heads of the principal agencies involved in managing the crisis, including the San Francisco police, firefighters and medical people, the mayor's Office of Emergency Services, and a representative of the governor. The experts from headquarters, who were even now flying from Washington to San Francisco in an FBI jet, would sit here. Around the room, groups of tables were set up for the different teams that would work on the case. Intelligence and investigation, the core of the effort, negotiation and SWAT teams that would be called in if hostages were taken, an administration and technical support team that would grow if the crisis escalated, a legal team to expedite search warrants, arrest warrants, or wiretaps, and an evidence response team which would enter any crime scene after the event and collect evidence. Laptop computers on each table were linked in a local network. The FBI had long used a paper-based information control system called Rapid Start, but now it had developed a computerized version using Microsoft Access software. But paper had not disappeared. Around two sides of the room, notice boards covered the walls. Lead status boards, event boards, subject boards, demand boards, and hostage boards. Key data and clues would be written up here so that everyone could see them at a glance. Right now, the subject board had one name, Richard Granger, and two pictures. The lead status board had a picture of a seismic vibrator. The room was big enough for a couple of hundred people, but so far, there were only about 40. They were mostly grouped around the intelligence and investigation table, speaking into phones, tapping keyboards, and reading files on screen. Judy had divided them into teams, each with a leader who monitored the others so that she could keep track of progress by talking to three people. There was an air of subdued urgency. Everyone was calm, but they were concentrating hard and working intensely. No one stopped for coffee or schmoozed over the photocopier or went outside for a cigarette. Later, if the situation developed into a full-blown crisis, the atmosphere would change, Judy knew. People would be yelling into phones, the expletive quotient would multiply, tempers would fray, and it would be her job to keep the lid on the cauldron. Remembering Beau's tip, she pulled up a chair next to Carl Theobald, a bright young agent in a fashionable dark blue shirt. He was the leader of the team reviewing Marvin Hayes's files.
"Anything?" she said.
He shook his head.
"We don't really know what we're looking for, but whatever it is, we haven't found it yet."
She nodded. She had given this team a vague task, but she could not help that. They had to look for something out of the ordinary. A lot depended on the intuition of the individual agent. Some people could smell deceit even in a computer.
"Are we sure we have everything on file?" she asked.
Carl shrugged.
"We should.
Check whether they kept any paper records."
"They're not supposed to,
but people do."
"Okay."
Rosa called her back to the head shed for a phone call. It was Michael. She smiled as she picked up.
"Hi."
"Hi. I've got a problem tonight. I can't make it."
She was shocked by his tone. He sounded curt and unfriendly. For the last few days, he had been warm and affectionate. But this was the original Michael, the one who had turned her away from his door and told her to make an appointment.
"What is it?" she said.
"Something came up. I'm sorry to cancel on you."
"Michael, what the hell is wrong?"
"I'm in kind of a rush. I'll call you."
"Okay,"
she said. He hung up.
She cradled the phone, feeling hurt. Now what was all that about? She said to herself. Just as I was getting fond of the guy. What is it with him? Why can't he stay the way he was on Sunday night? Or even when he called me this morning? Carl Theobald interrupted her thoughts. He looked troubled. Marvin Hayes is giving me a hard time, he said. They do have some paper records, but when I said I needed to see them, he pretty much told me to shove it. Don't worry, Carl, Judy said. These things are sent by heaven to teach us patience and tolerance. I'll just go and tear his balls off. The agents nearby heard her and laughed. Is that what patience and tolerance means? Carl said with a grin. I must remember that. Come with me, I'll show you, she said. They went outside and jumped in her car. It took 15 minutes to reach the federal building on Golden Gate Avenue. As they went up in the elevator, Judy wondered how to deal with Marvin. Should she tear his balls off or be conciliatory? The cooperative approach worked only if the other party was willing. With Marvin, she had probably gone past that point forever. She hesitated outside the door to the organized crime squad room. Okay, I'll be Xena, the warrior princess. She went in, and Carl followed. Marvin was on the phone, grinning broadly, telling a joke. So the barman says to the guy, there's a badger in the back room that gives the best blowjob. Judy leaned on his desk and said loudly, What's this crap you're giving Carl? Someone's interrupting me, Joe, he said. I'll call you right back. He hung up. What can I do for you, Judy? She leaned closer, putting herself in his face. Stop dicking around. What is it with you? He said, sounding aggrieved. What do you mean by going over my records as if I must have made some goddamn mistake? He had not necessarily made a mistake. When the perpetrator presented himself to the investigating team in the guise of a bystander or witness, he generally tried to make sure that they did not suspect him. It was not the fault of the investigators, but it was bound to make them feel foolish. "I think you may have talked to the perpetrator," she said. "Where are those paper records?" He smoothed his yellow tie. "All we have are some notes from the press conference that never got keyed into the computer." Show me. He pointed to a box file on a side table against the wall. Help yourself. She opened the file. On top was an invoice for the rental of a small public address system with microphones. You won't find a damn thing, Marvin said. He might be right, but she had to try, and it was dumb of him to obstruct her. A smarter man would have said, Hey, if I overlooked something, I sure hope you find it. Everyone made mistakes, but Marvin was now too defensive to be gracious. He just had to prove Judy wrong. It would be embarrassing if she was wrong. She rifled through the papers. There were some faxes from newspapers asking for details of the press conference, a note about how many chairs would be needed, and a guest list, a form on which the journalists attending the press conference had been asked to put their names and the publications or broadcasters they represented. Judy ran her eye down the list. "What the hell is this?" she said suddenly. "Florence Shoebury, Eisenhower Junior High?" "She wanted to cover the press conference for the school newspaper," Marvin said. "What should we do, tell her to fuck off?" "Did you check her out?" "She's a kid!" "Was she alone?" "Her father brought her." There was a business card stapled to the form. "Peter Shoebury from Watkins, Colfax and Brown. Did you check him out?" Marvin hesitated for a long moment, realizing he had made a mistake. "No," he said finally. "Brian decided to let them into the press conference, and afterward I never followed up." Judy handed the form with the business card to Carl. "Call this guy right away," she said. Carl sat at the nearest desk and picked up the phone. Marvin said, "Anyway, what makes you so sure we talked to the subject?" "My father thinks so." As soon as the words were out of her mouth, she realized she had made a mistake. Marvin sneered. "Oh, so your daddy thinks so. Is that the level we've sunk to? You're checking on me because your daddy told you to?" "Knock it off, Marvin. My father was putting bad guys in jail when you were still wetting your bed." "Where are you going with this, anyway? Are you trying to set me up? You looking for someone to blame when you fail?
What a great idea, she said. Why didn't I think of it?
Carl hung up the phone and said, Judy.
Yeah?
Peter Shoebury has never been inside this building, and he has no daughter. But he was mugged on Saturday morning 2 blocks from here, and his wallet was stolen. It contained his business cards.
There was a moment's silence, then Marvin said, Fuck it.
Judy ignored his embarrassment. She was too excited by the news. This could be a whole new source of information.
I guess he didn't look like the EFIT picture we got from Texas.
Not a bit, Marvin said. No beard, no hat. He had big glasses and long hair and a ponytail.
That's probably another disguise. What about his build and like that?
Tall, slim.
Dark hair, dark eyes, about 50.
Yes, yes, and yes.
Judy almost felt sorry for Marvin.
It was Ricky Granger, wasn't it?
Marvin looked at the floor as if he wanted it to open up and swallow him.
I guess you're right.
I would like you to produce a new EFIT, please.
He nodded, still not looking at her.
Sure.
Now what about Florence Shoebury?
Well, she kind of disarmed us. I mean, what kind of terrorist brings a little girl along with him?
One who is completely ruthless. What did the kid look like?
White girl, about 12, 13, dark hair, dark eyes, slim build, pretty.
Better do an EFIT of her, too.
Do you think she really is his daughter?
Oh, sure. That's how they seemed. She showed no signs of being under coercion, if that's what you're thinking.
Yes. Okay. I'm going to assume they're father and daughter for now.
She turned to Carl.
We're out of here.
They went out.
In the corridor, Carl said, Wow, you really did tear off his balls.
Judy was jubilant.
But we've got another subject, the kid.
Yeah, I just hope you never catch me making a mistake.
She stopped and looked at him.
It wasn't a mistake, Carl. Anyone can screw up. But he was willing to impede the investigation in order to cover up. That's where he went wrong. And that's why he looks like such an asshole now. If you make a mistake, admit it.
Yeah, Carl said. But I think I'll keep my legs crossed, too.
Late that evening, Judy got the first edition of the San Francisco Chronicle with the 2 new pictures. The EFIT of Florence Shoebury and the new EFIT of Ricky Granger disguised as Peter Shoebury. Earlier, she had only glanced at the pictures before asking Madge Kelly to get them to the newspapers and TV stations. Now, studying them by the light of her desk lamp, she was struck by the resemblance between Granger and Florence.
They're father and daughter, they have to be. I wonder what will happen to her if I put her daddy in jail.
She yawned and rubbed her eyes. Beau's advice came back to her. Take breaks, eat lunch, get the sleep you need. It was time to go home. The overnight shift was already here. Driving home, she reviewed the day and what she had achieved. Sitting at a stoplight, looking at twin rows of streetlights converging to infinity along Geary Boulevard, she realized that Michael had not faxed her the promised list of likely earthquake sites. She dialed his number on the car phone, but there was no answer. For some reason, that bothered her. She tried again at the next red light, and the number was busy. She called the office switchboard and asked them to check with Pacific Bell and find out whether there were voices on the line. The operator called her back and said there were not. The phone had been taken off the hook. So he was home, but not picking up. He had sounded odd when he called to cancel their date. He was like that. He could be charming and kind, then change abruptly and be difficult and arrogant. But why was his phone off the hook? Judy felt uneasy. She checked the dashboard clock. It was just before 11.
2 days left. I don't have time to screw around.
She turned the car around and headed for Berkeley. She reached Euclid Street at 11:15. There were lights on in Michael's apartment. Outside was an old orange Subaru. She had seen the car before, but did not know whose it was. She parked behind it and rang Michael's doorbell. There was no answer. Judy was troubled. Michael had crucial information. Today, on the very day she had asked him a key question, he had abruptly canceled an appointment, then had become incommunicado. It was suspicious. She wondered what to do. Maybe she should call for police backup and break in. He could be tied up or dead in there. She returned to her car and picked up the two-way radio, but she hesitated. When a man took the phone off the hook at 11 p.m., it might mean a variety of things. He might want to sleep. He might be getting laid, although Michael seemed too interested in Judy to play around. He was not the type to sleep with a different woman every night, she thought. While she was wavering, a young woman with a briefcase approached the building. She looked like an assistant professor returning home from a late evening at the lab. She stopped at the door and fumbled in her briefcase for keys. Impulsively, Judy jumped out of her car and walked quickly across the lawn to the entrance. "Good evening," she said. She showed her badge. "FBI Special Agent Judy Maddox. I need access to this building." "Something wrong?" the woman said anxiously. "I hope not. If you go to your apartment and close the door, you'll be just fine." They went in together. The woman entered a ground-floor apartment, and Judy went up the stairs. She rapped on Michael's door with her knuckles. There was no reply. What was going on? He was in there. He must have heard her ring and knock. He knew no casual caller would be so persistent at this time of night. Something was wrong, she felt sure. She knocked again, three times, hard. Then she put her ear to the door and listened. She heard a scream. That did it. She took a step back and kicked the door as hard as she could. She was wearing loafers, and she hurt the underside of her right foot, but the wood around the lock splintered. Thank God he did not have a steel door. She kicked it again. The lock seemed almost to break. She ran at the door with her shoulder, and it burst open. She drew her gun. "FBI!" she shouted. "Drop your weapons and put up your hands!" There was another scream. It sounded like a woman, she realized in the back of her mind, but there was no time to figure out what that signified. She stepped into the entrance lobby. Michael's bedroom door was open. She dropped to one knee with her arms extended and aimed into the room. What she saw stunned her. Michael was on the bed, naked, perspiring. He was on top of a thin woman with red hair who was breathing hard. It was his wife, Judy realized. They were making love. They both stared at Judy in fear and disbelief. Then Michael recognized her and said, "Judy? What the hell?" She closed her eyes. She had never felt like such a fool in her life. "Oh, shit," she said. "I'm sorry. Oh, shit." Chapter 15. Early on Wednesday, Priest stood beside the Silver River, looking at the way the morning sky was reflected in the broken planes of the water's shifting surface, marveling at the luminosity of blue and white in the dawn light. Everyone else was asleep. His dog sat beside him, panting quietly, waiting for something to happen. It was a tranquil moment, but Priest's soul was not at peace. His deadline was only 2 days away, and still Governor Robeson had said nothing. It was maddening. He did not want to trigger another earthquake. This one would have to be more spectacular, destroying roads and bridges, bringing skyscrapers tumbling down. People would die. Priest was not like Melanie, thirsting for revenge upon the world. He just wanted to be left alone. He was willing to do anything to save the commune, but he knew it would be smarter to avoid killing if he could. After this was all over and the project to dam the valley had been canceled, he and the commune wanted to live in peace. That was the whole point. And their chances of staying here undisturbed would be greater if they could win without killing innocent California citizens. What had happened so far could be forgotten soon enough. It would drop out of the news, and no one would care what became of the nutcases who said they could trigger earthquakes. As he stood musing, Star appeared. She slipped out of her purple robe and stepped into the cold river to wash. Priest looked hungrily at her voluptuous body, familiar but still desirable. He had shared his bed with no one last night. Star was still spending her nights with Bones, and Melanie was with her husband in Berkeley. So the great coxman sleeps alone. While she was toweling herself dry, Priest said, "Let's go get a newspaper. I want to know if Governor Robeson said anything last night. They got dressed and drove to a gas station. Priest filled the tank of the Cuda while Starr got the San Francisco Chronicle. She came back white-faced. Look, she said, showing him the front page. There was a picture of a young girl who looked familiar. After a moment, he realized with horror that it was Flower. Stunned, he picked up the newspaper. Beside the picture of Flower was one of himself. Both were computer-generated images. The one of Priest was based on his appearance at the FBI press conference, when he had been disguised as Peter Shoebury, with his hair pulled back and wearing large glasses. He did not think anyone would recognize him from that. Flower had not been in disguise. Her computer picture was like a poorly drawn portrait. Not her, but like her. Priest felt cold. He was not used to fear. He was a daredevil who enjoyed risk. But this was not about him. He had put his daughter in danger. Starr said angrily, "Why the hell did you have to go to that press conference?" "I had to know what they were thinking. It was so dumb. I've always been rash." "I know." Her voice softened, and she touched his cheek. "If you were timid, you wouldn't be the man I love." A month ago it would not have mattered. No one outside the commune knew Flower, and no one inside read newspapers. But she had been going secretly to Silver City to meet boys. She had stolen a poster from a store. She had been arrested. And she had spent a night in custody. Would the people she had met remember her? And if so, would they recognize the picture? The probation officer might remember her, but luckily he was still on vacation in the Bahamas, where he was unlikely to see the San Francisco Chronicle. But what about the woman who had guarded her overnight? A schoolteacher who was also the sheriff's sister, Priest recalled. Her name came back. Miss Waterlow. She saw hundreds of little girls, presumably, but she might remember their faces. Maybe she had a bad memory. Maybe she had gone on vacation, too. Maybe she had not read today's Chronicle. And maybe Priest was finished. There was nothing he could do about it. If the schoolteacher saw the picture and recognized Flower and called the FBI, 100 agents would descend on the commune and it would be all over. He stared at the paper while Starr read the text. "If you didn't know her, would you recognize her?" Starr shook her head. "I don't think so." "I don't either, but I wish I were sure." "I didn't think the feds were this goddamn smart," Starr said. "Some are, some aren't. It's this Asian girl that worries me, Judy Maddox." Priest recalled the TV pictures of her, so slender and graceful, pushing through a hostile crowd with a look of bulldog determination on her delicate features. "I got a bad feeling about her," he said, "a real bad feeling. She keeps coming up with leads. First the seismic vibrator, then the picture of me and Shiloh, now Flower. Maybe that's why Governor Robeson hasn't said anything. She's got him hoping we'll be caught. Is there a statement from the governor in the paper?" "No. According to this report, a lot of people are saying Robeson should give in and negotiate with the Hammer of Eden, but he refuses to comment." "This is no good," he said. "I've got to find a way to talk to him." When Judy woke up, she could not remember why she felt so bad. Then the whole ghastly scene came back in a dreadful rush. Last night she had been paralyzed with embarrassment. She had mumbled an apology to Michael and run out of the building, burning with shame. But this morning her mortification had been replaced by a different feeling. Now she just felt sad. She had thought Michael might become part of her life. She had been looking forward to getting to know him, growing more fond of him, making love to him. She had imagined that he cared for her. But the relationship had crashed and burned in no time. She sat up in bed and looked at the collection of Vietnamese water puppets she had inherited from her mother, arranged on a shelf above the chest of drawers. She had never seen a puppet show, had never been to Vietnam, but her mother had told her how the puppeteers stood waist-deep in a pond, behind a backdrop, and used the surface of the water as their stage. For hundreds of years, such painted wooden toys had been used to tell wise and funny tales. They always reminded Judy of her mother's tranquility. What would she say now? Judy could hear her voice, low and calm. "A mistake is a mistake. Another mistake is normal. Only the same mistake twice makes you a fool." Last night had just been a mistake. Michael had been a mistake. She had to put all that behind her. She had 2 days to prevent an earthquake. That was really important. On the TV news, people were arguing about whether the Hammer of Eden might really be able to trigger an earthquake. The believers had formed a pressure group to urge Governor Robeson to give in. But as she got dressed, Judy's mind kept returning to Michael. She wished she could speak to her mother about it. She could hear Beau stirring, but this was not the kind of thing to tell your father about. Instead of making breakfast, she called her friend Virginia. "I need someone to talk to," she told her. "Have you had breakfast yet?" They met at a coffee shop near the Presidio. Ginny was a petite blonde, funny and honest. She would always tell Judy exactly what she thought. Judy ordered 2 chocolate croissants to make herself feel better, then related what had happened last night. When she came to the part where she burst in with her gun in her hand and found them screwing, Ginny practically fell down laughing. "I'm sorry," she said, and got a piece of toast stuck in her throat. "I guess it is kind of funny," Judy said, smiling. "But it didn't seem that way last night, I can tell you." Ginny coughed and swallowed. "I don't mean to be cruel," she said when she had recovered. "I can see it wasn't too hilarious at the time. What he did was really sleazy, dating you and sleeping with his wife." "To me it shows that he's not over her," Judy said. "So he's not ready for a new relationship."